afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anthony Bubalo, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Lowy Institute for International Policy. Welcome to this afternoon's In Conversation event on the Iranian presidential elections. As many of you would know, next week, on May 19th to be exact, Iran goes to the polls to elect its new president. Now, under normal, I mean, this is obviously a fairly consequential event every 4 years in Iran, but under normal circumstances, it might this election might be a little less consequential in the sense that the current incumbent, President Hassan Rouhani, is up for his second term, and typically Iranian presidents win their second term of office. But this time, there are reasons to believe that the election will be even more consequential than it normally is. First, it's the first Iranian presidential election since Iran struck an accord with the international community over its nuclear program. Now, that nuclear accord was pushed very hard by President Rouhani within Iran, and he promised certainly to the Iranian people that it would deliver great economic benefits. So in some respects, this poll is something of a referendum on his performance, or a referendum on his performance and the performance of that agreement so far. Second, and even more obviously, the international environment around Iran has shifted somewhat, particularly with the election of President Trump in the United States. President Trump has promised to take a tougher approach to Iran. He hasn't quite promised to tear up the nuclear accord, but he's certainly promised to take a tougher approach. His first visit, in fact, outside the US, is going to be to Saudi Arabia, where it's very likely that he will be meeting not just with the Saudis, but with other American allies in the region, and a top order of business is going to be pushback against Iran in the region. So in some respects, the election is also an opportunity for the Iranian people and to some degree the Iranian regime to say, to respond in some respects to this shift in the international environment around Iran. So for these and other reasons, I'm really glad that we could be joined here today by our panel of experts who will help us to explore some of these issues and the consequences that are likely to result from them surrounding the election. So on my far left, we have Roger Shanahan. Roger is a familiar figure here at the Lowy Institute. He's a research fellow here, of course. He's a former army officer and a former defence attaché who'd had postings with the Australian embassies in Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. But he's also a Middle Eastern scholar of great repute. He's written in particular on Shia politics in the Middle East and has long experience and is a regular contributor to the Australian media on Middle Eastern issues. Sitting next to Roger is Alice Drury. Alice is an Australian lawyer, we won't hold that against her, who completed her master's in Iranian studies at the University of Tehran between 2014 and 2016. Quite a unique experience. I think you were one of the first or second cohorts doing that particular course at Tehran University. While she was there, she also advised the Iranian Chamber of Commerce. And most importantly, she was once a research intern here at the Lowy Institute. I'll tell you how far you can go as after spending a little while as a research institute. And last but certainly not least, we have Nasser Ghobazadeh, who is a research fellow at the Institute for Social Justice at the Australian Catholic University. His interests lie in the study of Islamic political theology, secularism, state religion, society relations, and Iranian politics. And he's, of course, himself from Iran. Please join me in welcoming our guests. So, look, it's important. I mean, there are lots and lots of questions we can ask about this election, and Iranian politics is hugely fascinating, certainly for me, and we could talk all day about it. But I think it's important in the beginning just to get some of the basic parameters to understand a little bit about what the election means and how and the role of the president in the system. So can I turn to you, Nasser, just to explain to us the kind of the significance of the election and the role that the president plays in the context of the broader Iranian political system?
Thanks, Anthony, and it's great to be here. I think it's a good place to start, and if you allow me, I will use this question to bring up maybe a more fundamental question that we have generally forgot to ask over the last, I don't know, almost four decades. And that's basically to think about what kind of regime we are dealing with. It seems to me that when the 1979 revolution happened, we were shocked. I mean, the whole world was shocked. It was not expected. And more importantly, nobody knew what's happening. I mean, the political Islam was quite a new phenomenon back then, and particularly the Shiite version was very, I mean, unknown in the Western context. And there was this huge debate discussing about what has emerged from this incident. And it seems that back then we solved the problem, we answered the question that this is Islamic State, an authoritarian dictatorship, and we put it aside, and we haven't thought about it. And thinking about every election and the role of president, it's important to see that in what framework, with what political context it's happening. I think Iran's system, political system, is not simply authoritarian or dictatorship or theocracy, as it is used in the literature in the public area as well. I think it falls within the category of system that after the post-World War era, they are called electoral authoritarian regimes. That elections are a significant and important part of the system, which plays important roles, but not in terms of the democratizing or bringing up a democratic system. So we need to see this presidential election, president roles within that electoral authoritarian system. And maybe for Iran, we can use the electoral theocracy instead of authoritarian, because the other part is more religiously based system. And if we think from within this framework, we will see that the president has a great deal of power, but it is limited, as within the other electoral authoritarian system, it is limited. I think that the president and the electoral bodies of the system are capable of policy changes, which is very important, particularly for those Iranian who live in Iran. I mean, it matters a lot. Elections make significant important changes in their lives. As well as there is a sort of power shift. I mean, if you look back to the old presidential election after the revolution, every 8 years, 2 terms, there has been a power shift between the different factions of the within internal factions. So the role of president is very important and plays a very significant role in policy making and the daily life of the Iranians, but not at the terms of democratizing or changing the whole system.
So, and of course, at the head of the system, you have the supreme leader, which is not an elected position in the sense of being elected in a general election. Well, explain to us a little bit about the relationship between the supreme leader and the president.
Again, it's not very simple. It's more complicated. Of course, there is a power relations happen. It depends who is the president and what level of power the president claims. Mm-hmm. Example, if you look back to the all presidents after the Khamenei became supreme leader, in the second term, they have had more conflict with the supreme leader because they have been able to bring up their powers, they get their own people. So they reach to the point that they can challenge, I mean, implicitly, of course, not explicitly, the supreme leader and his decisions. Because, of course, supreme leader is the one who is leading the whole system in a way, the major strategic decisions. But even he intervene in the policy level as well, in the daily politics. I mean, there is, interestingly, 2 days ago, there was a statement, a very harsh, strong statement by Supreme Leader against this document by the UNESCO, which apparently the Iranian government, Rouhani's state, I mean, signed up to that, and the Supreme Leader came up to the public saying that, oh, I won't agree to this, and mm-hmm. they had to stop it. So Supreme Leader always engage in the policies at the policy level, and then if the president is weak, which is usually the case in the first term, Ahmadinejad was a good example, Rouhani is somehow, but in the second term, when they are more powerful, then the conflict arises more higher. But the history shows that Supreme Leader has been able to manage so far even the most radical, most extremist version of Ahmadinejad, which challenged him very, very openly.
Roger, so let's turn to the question now of who's running. Who are the main contestants in the election? We know that the incumbent, President Hassan Rouhani, is running again for his second term. As I said in the introduction, it's generally been the case that presidents win their second term. Who's he facing, and what are his chances?
Well, it's I think for people who follow US electoral politics, the Iranian presidential election is very short and sharp by contrast, because you have to put yourself up to be nominated to run for president. And in this election, over 1,600 people put their names forward to the Council of Guardians, which was about...
By the Republican Party in the US.
So it's about 1,000 more than in the previous election. So you imagine how much time you can allocate to some of the, let's call them, fringe candidates. And then at the end of the day, it boiled down to six candidates. To use really rough terminology, because as been pointed out, the complexity of the Iranian political system, there's three on the centrist side and three on the principalists or the more conservative side. And two of those are two Mustafas, Hashmi Taba and Mustafa Mirsalam. You could probably say that they don't really have a chance and they're there to more or less make up numbers. It leaves, therefore, two on the conservative side and two on the reform side. And again, you could say that the vice president, who has been nominated, is probably going to pull out prior to the presidential election or the runoff for the election. So we're really looking at three: President Rouhani, who is very substantial figure by any measure. He's been national security advisor to two presidents. He's been the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council. He's also got a PhD from a Scottish university. He's also been lead nuclear negotiator in 2003. He is a figure of significant substance running for his second term, where traditionally presidents do get a second term. And the two conservative candidates running against him is the current and third term mayor of Tehran, and also what we would consider the clerical candidate. And I suppose when you're looking at the three candidates who are in the race, one of the issues about getting a feel on who is the favourite is there's only about 20 days between the time when the candidates have been nominated and election day, and there's three televised electoral debates. I think it's the second time they've had electoral debates, so it's very difficult for people to get a sense of the public opinion monitor, because you only really know who the candidates are 3 weeks before you're supposed to vote for them. Now, the Tehrani mayor is probably the lesser likely of the three. This will be his third presidential election. He was in the runoff in 2013, and President Rouhani won in the first round of voting, which it's probably about 50-50% of the times when the candidate wins in the first round of elections. Rouhani got a squeak over 50%. Tehrani mayor got 16% of the vote. So you can show the kind of, when it comes down to a two-horse race, people often say they can throw up a dark horse, and Rouhani was probably in 2013, could be considered somewhat of a dark horse, but he's certainly not a dark horse anymore. So I think most people would say that it's Rouhani's to lose at the moment. And again, public opinion polling is difficult to look at with any degree of certainty, but certainly the last opinion poll that I saw had Rouhani at about 45% of the vote, so he's certainly going to get, if there is a second round, he's certainly going to be one of the two candidates in the second round of voting, and his two conservative opponents were in the 20%. So we're really looking at the question at the moment, I think, that we've got to ask is, will Rouhani get through on the first round of voting? And if he doesn't get through on the first round of voting, will all the issues that we're going to talk about, largely economic issues, come back to bite him. But I just think kind of the pedigree of Rouhani, the kind of promise that he has potentially for the future means that he's going to get, and the history of Iranian presidential elections means that I think he's going to get a second term.
Roger, I want to just kind of focus on the two conservative candidates, the kind of Merit Iran Khalibov and the, you know, the clerical candidate, in a sense, as you call him, Ibrahim Raisi. It's an interesting kind of situation, right? In a sense, it splits the principalist kind of vote potentially. There seemed to be this expectation that you know, Raisi is the supreme leader's man, and that, you know, the conservatives should fall into line by him. But Khalibov seems to be kind of clinging on to the campaign. What does that kind of tension between the two of them tell us about the conservative camp at the moment in Iran?
Well, I suppose there was talk early on that Raisi was perhaps the candidate and Khalibov was there just to make up numbers, and that somewhere along the line Khalibov would drop out. But certainly in the presidential debates, he's made a particularly strong showing and doesn't give it any indication that he's going to be just a make-up-the-numbers third-time candidate. So it might be that notion that both of these candidates are going to steal votes off each other. That may make Rouhani's chances of getting through on the first round greater. But as you've seen before, lots of things happen in Iranian politics which can't be predicted. But Raisi is the classic clerical candidate. He has a PhD in Islamic law. He's been prosecuted in various constituencies in Iran, and he's also been the Attorney General in Iran. He's currently the chairman of the foundation of the Imam Reza Mosque in Mashhad. So he's a serious of the Islamic revolution, of the theocratic leadership candidate, whereas Khalibov is certainly of the revolution. He's been a previous commander of the Revolutionary Guard Air Forces, and a three-time mayor. But he's also now facing, after the building collapse in Tehran, that damaged his reputation, which had always been a reputation of I can get things done kind of person. And in the Rouhani camp, you're also seeing them trying to smear the mayor by saying that people in the city council have been guilty of taking bribes, which is a fairly common kind of accusation to make. But that, on top of the building collapse, just adds an air of uncertainty about Mr. Kendu is possibly not Mr. Kendu anymore, and also a twice loser of presidential election. He's not the person that you're going to vote for.
Alice, I wanted to turn now to the kind of issues surrounding the election, at least for Iranian people. You know, when we talk about Iran in the West, often we talk about, you know, the nuclear program or the geopolitical kind of question, the tensions between Iran and Israel or Iran and the United States. How much do these issues loom large for ordinary Iranians? What are the issues that people will vote on the day? What are the issues that will actually bring them to vote? Because obviously turnout is also a really important factor here.
Yeah, turnout is important, but it is actually something that Iran is usually pretty strong on. Not surprisingly and not unusually, the number one issue when you talk to Iranians almost every time is the economy. And that could be true of pretty much any election in any country, but I think particularly at the moment what we're seeing is an interesting shift in Iran. Whereas the election of Ahmadinejad was perhaps more what I would describe as pursuing economic justice, and about sort of taking back these privatized companies and distributing the wealth among the poor Iranians. I feel like this election is more about economic recovery. And within the economy, we can, you know, it's often quite difficult to find commentary that actually drills down about specifically what is it about the economy that is so important. And I do think at the moment it is about job creation. Iran has of course, very young population, about a third of whom are unemployed. And those of whom who can find employment are paid, you know, miserably low amounts. And many of the young people that I spoke to were also feeling the squeeze. So it means that they can't then move out of home and they can't exercise the other freedoms that they would ordinarily want to and expect to. And to my mind, that leaves them with a logical the most logical candidate, who is Rouhani. It was not long ago that even just the feeling and the mood in the streets in Iran, that was before I was there, but a lot of people spoke about it. It was a lot more tense under Ahmadinejad. And that is that kind of tension and the morality police and the storming in on parties and things like that can very much be expected to... We can expect Iran to return to that if either Qalibaf or certainly Raisi become the next presidents. And I have to say, in my experience among the older generation of Iranians, they're pretty sympathetic to that as well. That's not to say that there isn't a very large contingent of quite conservative, quite religious, very pro-government or pro-supreme leader kind of Iranians. There are, and they never have any issues getting enough thousands of people down into Enghelabi Street or Revolutionary Road for the celebration of the anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. But overwhelmingly, the Iranians that I came across over a couple of years, they may be, socially conservative themselves, and they may be religious, but they're moderate in their political views.
It kind of brings back, one of the interesting things here, it wasn't that long ago in terms of Iranian presidential elections, the 2009 election, that you famously saw as a result of a perception that the regime had somehow manipulated the election, this outpouring of protest that some people have called the kind of precursor to the Arab uprisings that it went on to inspire similar protests much later in 2011 in the Arab world. I mean, how you're in a kind of unique position living in Tehran as a Western woman, different kind of access if you're a Western man, for example, in terms of the people you could engage with. How do you reconcile that image of, young people on the streets demanding great liberty with what you found in terms of what were the big issues that they were concerned about, that younger Iranians in particular, that preoccupied their time and their energies?
Yeah, it was interesting actually, and kind of quite conflicting. So on the one hand, attitudes haven't changed since 2009. The things that they were calling for and the Green Movement is still very much alive. But what has happened, and what a lot of the young people who may have been involved in the 2009 movement previously, or were at least of that generation, what they're much more mindful of now and making them a little bit perhaps more gun-shy is the fact that the Arab Spring has since happened, and it has brought war to almost all of Iran's borders. And I've had a few conversations with, who would be considered very like lefty, progressive young Iranians saying, we don't want that. And as critical as we are of the government as to what happened during 2009, they actually sort of said, well, we have to give the government credit. They didn't let our country fall to pieces. They didn't let it unravel. So that's a kind of... The other thing to bear in mind, actually, is, at least in my experience, is people don't really talk about 2009 now. Mm. They were burnt. And the movement also kind of fell to pieces. So I think on the one hand, I gather the government is still a bit nervous about having that happen again. But on the other hand, they perhaps have less reason to be. I think people are more gun-shy.
Yeah. Nasser, as I said in the introduction, to some degree, the election is a little bit of a referendum on the JCPOA, on the nuclear deal. President Rouhani advocated hard for that deal. He said it would help to address many of Iran's problems, particularly economic problems. How do you think Iranians feel about the deal and today, and how, and in what way might that affect the way they vote next week?
Maybe I'm not the right person to answer that question because I'm not living in Iran, so it should be good to have a first-hand observation. Mm. But I will have my point on that. But if you allow me, going back to the question about the economy and what the people are interested, I like to make a point over that because I think it's very important to see a very decisive transformations that has happened in Iran's political culture as well as at the social cultural level. Mm-hmm. And that's these campaigns and also the way that they are dealing with the international context, the people that the way that they defending the Iran's policies in the Syria, in Iraq, or other parts of the world is very important. The main thing that you are seeing missed from the both the people's rhetoric as well as the officials' rhetoric, except the supreme leader and his campaign camp, is this religious values, this ideological dimension. Even if you see the president's candidates are talking about defending their position in the Syria, it's more defending our own safety, security, national interest. There is no any conversation about that we are expanding our, I don't know, ideology, exporting revolution, or this sort of the things is totally missing from the campaigns, and that it's the time that they are trying to get the votes. And I think that a significant transformation is happening in Iran, which I would call it a sort of renaissance, that people are getting away from these religious values. And that's why you see that many people are moderates. I mean, you won't come across many radical Iranians in terms of the religious thing. That's why campaigns is focused on economy. Even the conservatives, hardliners, they are not talking about the increasing religiosity or exporting revolution or this sort of the things which were very common back then in 1980s, even 1990s. Nowadays, it's totally changed and it's more about the good governance, how can deliver a good governance.
It's a supreme irony, isn't it? It's the kind of Islamist regimes have all, you know, Islamist activism has always run on the we want to put Islam back at the center of life. Mm. And here you have the classic Islamist regime in Tehran, in Iran, less than 40 years since the revolution, and it seems to have done exactly the opposite.
Exactly. That's a backlash that I'm talking about. I mean, there are many signs for that. I mean, if you do a sort of discourse analysis, you will find it everywhere. Mm-hmm. For example, one of the things years ago I did was this names. In Iran, we have three kinds of names. The first kind is the most Arabic names. I mean, like my name is Arabic name. It's not Iranian. And there are Iranian names which come from the pre-Islamic era, like the Darwish or Cyrus and this sort of names. And there are Western names. You cannot choose Western names for your children. I mean, there's a list that it's forbidden and you cannot choose Western names. But if you look to the names that the Iranian has chosen for their children in the third decades after the revolution, it's all Iranian names. I mean, it's a huge drop in the names, the religious names like, I mean, Fatima, Ali, I don't know, this Nasser, this sort of names. Nobody chose those names. And it shows that how this cultural, I mean, religious transformation has happened, that they are getting away from religious values towards more secular, nationalistic values, which I'm not putting it in a way of normative way saying it's a good thing or bad thing, but I'm saying that's an observation that's happened. And going back to the nuclear thing, I think that unfortunately it's not just in Iran, all over the world. I mean, we usually forget things very quickly. I mean, when it comes to the politics particularly. 4 years ago, we were standing in a position that every day we were scared that, oh, there's going to be attack, there's going to be the currency, the rate was changing rapidly, and nothing was stable. And now things has changed. I mean, at least we are in a stable situation. I don't know, from my personal conversations with friends and family, I still think that the vibe that I get is that almost all those that I know are still voting for Rouhani. They are supporting the line of the changes that he has started. But, I mean, Iran's politics is always surprised. I mean, it has always surprised me and everybody, and we cannot make a prediction that if the nuclear deal will be the decisive element in the election or not. Because nowadays, it's not a big deal. It's not a problem right now, that the main problem. So maybe it won't play that role that it is supposed to play. 4 years ago, obviously it played, because Jalili was the nuclear negotiator, and I'm sure that many people, I mean, vote for Rouhani just to avoid Jalili's presidency, which would be, I mean, very, very dangerous for the country, for the whole country.
Alice, do you want to come in on this in terms of, you know, people? I know at the time the deal was struck, there seemed to be, you know, in some respects, quite euphoric. You know, things are going to change overnight in Iran. You know, it's going to open up. It's going to become Dubai. Clearly hasn't happened. I mean, how do you think, what's your view on how people, or people's expectations and how that might play into the election?
It's a an interesting question. Sorry, just to jump back to the point that you were saying before, I don't know if you've been following the presidential debates. There's been two so far, and it's very difficult to actually distinguish between each of the candidates because just listening to them, they all seem moderate. to get the votes, you have to appear moderate these days, which gives you a good indication of where the Iranian population's at. To go back to that question, I know that there was a lot of film about people yipping and yahooing in Tajrish that sort of made the Western media.
Tajrish
in the kind of northern, it's this quite well-known square up in the northern Tehran, just a suburb in Tehran. And the numbers by Iranian standards were quite low, the number of people who turned out in the streets. And I think people were very happy. Unfortunately, I wasn't in the country. I was back in Australia for a week. But people were certainly very pleased that it had passed, but also incredibly cynical that it was going to make a big impact upon their lives. That sense of euphoria never really seemed to trickle through for me. I was more euphoric than most of the Iranians that I was speaking to. And I think that's because they've just had perhaps too many years or too many generations, or one taxi driver said to me, Iran is like a boat. We're always being flung around in troubled waters. We're never calm and stable and happy. And there was also a real degree of cynicism on the basis that even when all of this money from overseas is recovered and even when international investment starts to come in, corruption means that the little guy will never see it anyway. So that was my experience of the nuclear deal being passed.
Roger, I want to talk now about some of the issues around the election, but less for the Iranian people, more for the kind of various political players within the regime. I want to understand its significance. Now, one of the interesting kind of elements has been Ibrahim Raisi's kind of candidature, primarily because he's been portrayed, whether it's true or not is another question, he's been portrayed as a potential successor to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. There are some, how much is that, do you think, playing into the election and his candidature?
Yeah, I suppose I'll just add one thing to what we're speaking about here before, but in those, and that notion of the nuclear agreement and unrealised expectations. But I think when Foreign Minister Zarif was in Australia and he gave some talks here, one of the questions that he got from the audience was, are you attuned to the fact that expectations are going to be so extraordinarily high that you're never going to be able to make them, so anything that you do achieve is going to be below expectations? And you got the sense from Mr. Zarif that he understood that but could never really acknowledge that it was anything but a good thing. But I think the economic situation in Iran, which you might get onto after, is so difficult and so complicated. And in the debates, if you think there are some non-substantive economic promises being made in Australian electoral debates, then you should listen to the Iranian electoral debates, because they're in cloud and cloud cuckoo land to a degree. But back to what Anthony said, again, if you think the Iranian electoral system for president is opaque and difficult to predict, how a successor to the supreme leader is going to be chosen and who it is going to be is even more opaque. And this probably isn't the time or the place to talk about it. But Raisi, if you were to present a model relatively young candidate to be supreme leader, then somebody like Raisi would be that candidate. As I said before, he has excellent Islamic jurisprudential qualifications. The question that's going to be really interesting about when the succession does occur, and the assembly of experts, the people who appoint the supreme leader, is we're not there at the moment, but we're now getting the first tranche of people, somebody like Raisi, who were very junior during the Islamic Revolution, whereas both Khomeini and now Khamenei, and even somebody like Rouhani, have been very central figures during the defining pivotal experience of not only the revolution but also the Iran-Iraq war, you know, the 8 years following the Iranian revolution. And that gives people great kudos in terms of personifying what the Islamic revolution is all about and defending it. Somebody like Raisi is at the very tail end of that. So is the Assembly of Experts going to be wanting to promote somebody who's that junior, or are they going to want to promote somebody of the same kind of qualifications but whose experiences are rooted much more in that really defining moment? But the problem, as we pointed out with Raisi, if indeed Raisi is a possibility for Supreme Leader, and this is, again, just wild postulation, Khamenei was a two-term president before he became Supreme Leader. If, as is possible and most likely probable, Raisi loses the presidential election, what does that do in terms of people's perception of his ability to be Supreme Leader? Can you be Supreme Leader knowing that the population wasn't prepared to elect you as president, whereas the previous Supreme Leader had been? It's a question nobody can really answer. And one of the theories, and I'd be interested to hear Nasser's take on this, is while he has excellent credentials, his profile has been quite low because he's been a prosecutor, he wasn't Attorney General till 2014, and his accession to the chairmanship of the Foundation for Mashhad, for Imam Reza, is possibly another way of increasing his profile in a non-juridical sense or a non-prosecutorial sense. That makes really a strong argument until we come back to that. Why would you risk that carefully manufactured accession by possibly losing a presidential race? Because I think losing a presidential electoral race is going to cost you more than you've gained in being Attorney General and the Chairman of the Foundation.
Time is rushing past, and I do want to give an opportunity to members of the audience to ask some questions. But I just wanted to kind of end our little kind of section of this just by looking at some of the geopolitical issues. And maybe a question to all three of you. Nasser was talking about electoral authoritarianism. We have a still relatively new president in the US. That, as I said in the introduction, that's kind of, you know, reasonably dramatically changed the environment around Iran, you know, from a US president who seemed to be going out of his way to kind of build bridges with Iran, most famously the nuclear deal, to a president who is kind of openly confrontational. How do you think what will the election signal in terms of either the Iranian people or the Iranian regime's view of the environment? I mean, you know, in a sense, if they re-electing Rouhani, does that mean that they want to continue in this, you know, relatively pragmatic approach? If they go with someone like Raisi, does that signal that they want to, be a little more defiant? Or do these geopolitical issues really not matter at all? Maybe start with you, Nasser.
Yep, I think it's more important to look, to see what Trump is going to do. That part is more important than Iran's part. Within Iran, I think when it comes to the foreign policy, how people are thinking, what's their, feeling about the foreign policy has never mattered in Iran's politics. Yeah. I mean, not after revolution, but even before revolution. I mean, the Mohammad Reza Shah didn't care how people think about the foreign policy. And I don't think that Khamenei cares much about the people's ideas about the foreign policy. And I strongly believe that at least the strategic direction and approach of the Iranian government towards the foreign policy and international issues, particularly when it comes to the issue of Syria or Iraq, as well as the U.S. relations, it is decided by Khamenei and the Office of Supreme Leader. I don't see Khamenei as just one single person. The Office of the Supreme Leader is a massive establishment right now. I mean, it's not like even the Khomeini's time. I mean, Khomeini's time was just Ahmad Khomeini, his son, and a few other people working in his office. Now it's much, bigger than state apparatus, the Supreme Leader Office. And I don't know, it's very hard to say, but I don't see any sign of Supreme Leader having a second thought about the way that they are managing the foreign relations, I mean, including the relations with the US or Syria. Mm-hmm. Even they see that very strong hold of their policies over the last decade. So, and I don't know if at some point, for any reason, because of the Trump's unexpected decision or something, he will come across to make some changes in his policy. And then, of course, the state will be implementing that policy. That's what happened in the nuclear deal. I mean, the nuclear deal had started before Rouhani, and Rouhani just implemented what had already been decided in a way. So I cannot say that that's going to happen, and I cannot see a sign of Supreme Leader has in rethinking his policy. Or...
Alice, Roger, do you want to add anything to that?
I suppose also, you know, normally all politics is local, and as Nasser pointed out, you know, foreign policy is the preserve, really, of the Supreme Leader's office. But I think in some senses, Iran, more so than other countries domestically, feels the impact of foreign policy decisions. And again, I just think that in the current uncertain circumstances, people have more confidence that somebody like Rouhani understands the geopolitical structure and systems better than his opponents. And I think, if anything, if it does have an impact on the domestic presidential elections, I think that's another reason to vote for Rouhani as a steady hand on the tiller, and you've already seen what he's achieved in the 4 years.
Alice?
Yeah, I'd just say that this is, I think this is a relationship very much more in America's hands than Iran's, but the best that Iran could hope for would to make itself as small of a target as possible, and that means voting in Rouhani.
Okay, so we'll take some questions now from the audience. Raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question to one or all of our panelists, and wait for the microphone, and then let us tell us who you are before you ask a question. Down the front here.
Yeah, just a question about if Rouhani gets re-elected. When he was originally elected, there was expectations that he would implement a social reform agenda, changes to rights of women, bad hijab, all that type of things, and that got very much shot down, if you like, a lot of resistance from the CG and the other arms of government. If he gets re-elected, do you see, or this is really to anybody, is there any prospect that that reform agenda may be reinvigorated, such as allowing changes of religion, allowing women to optionally wear the hijab?
Who'd like to take that one?
One of the key features of electoral authoritarian regimes is that they have the opportunity through the elections, I mean, make partial reforms. And that's what has happened in Iran as well. I mean, if you look to the Rouhani's era, they needed to make some reforms in economic as well as the international relations. And through elections, they facilitate making these changes without making a major, I mean, change, losing reputation, their images of that we have given up all this, our ideological or whatever slogan that they use. And I think Rouhani succeeded in economy and international relations, particularly with the nuclear deal, but he didn't care much about the political reform as well as the social reform. And I don't know if he is going to take that those challenge in the second term. I don't see any reason for him because, I mean, if you look even to Rouhani's background, he doesn't belong to the reformist camp. I mean, now he's playing that game, obviously. But if you look to the Khatami's era, he was in the conservative camp, and he was against all these political reforms, social reforms that Khamenei was pushing for them back then. So I think that the first thing is that I don't know how, to some extent, to what extent he believes in this sort of reforms, or maybe he believes in some limited scale of the reforms to just get the votes that he wants. And then the other case is that if he wants to take that challenge with Khamenei or not. That's the important question, I think.
So I'll probably just say, I think in the first term as well, his focus, you know, I agree with what Nasser said, but also his focus was on getting the nuclear agreement, and that even if he was ideologically disposed to these social reforms, that was the trade-off domestically because he couldn't take the country forward internationally and domestically. At the same time, he would have met too much resistance So the path of least resistance was not to push on that. I think if he is in the second term elected, then his priority is going to be economic reforms, and part of those economic reforms possibly may be trying to lessen the power of the Revolutionary Guard aligned companies, and if that's the case, then there's another reason not to be pushing on the social reform. So I wouldn't expect much movement on that side.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's also a matter of not underestimating what he's done to change and to shift the dialogue more to the centre anyway, even among politicians.
Down here.
Thank you. I was just wondering to what extent do the panellists think that the Iranian-Australian relationship is important, and what impact, if any, will the presidential election have on the relationship between Iran and Australia?
I might jump in there just for a second. I think one of the points a friend of mine made was that the voting in of Rouhani is quite important from a business perspective because it shows continuity in Iran and it shows that there is a degree of political safety and security on the ground, which is at the moment making everybody nervous and preventing that big influx of foreign investment, which is what they were expecting. And I think Australia could play quite a key facilitative role in Iran if Rouhani is voted in the sort of business sphere. And we have managed to avoid most of the political controversies with Iran. We've kept our, we kept our trade office open when a lot of other countries, Western countries, closed theirs. So I think if Iran continues down the path that it's going down, Australia could actually sort of play quite an important role.
Roger.
Yeah, I think that Alice said one of the positives for Australia is we've maintained diplomatic representation in Iran where other countries haven't. I suppose one of the, looking from a purely business perspective, and again, I think Foreign Minister Zarif was quick to acknowledge this, the legislative basis for foreign investment in Iran is difficult in terms of contractual law, is difficult. It's not set up for ease of business. That having been said, some Australian companies have set up offices in Iran in anticipation of a long-term relationship. There are a couple of carpetbaggers who went there sensing a quick win. I think if you're in that economic game, it's not going to happen. You have to be there for the long term. And the companies that did move there tended to open branch offices from their main offices elsewhere in the Gulf. So they were used to the kind of business culture, but also they had a long lead time. They don't need to make a profit straight away. They're looking kind of 5 years hence. So I think those companies that have a long-term view of dealing with Iran economically, you will have to take a chance. But I think if you're looking with a long-term view, those are the ones that are going to be more successful than anybody who thinks there's going to be a quick turnaround of capital.
My name's John Murphy. I don't have any particular political affiliation. Just regarding Iranian society and its development, are we moving towards a more secular society? And with that, are we likely to see a lessening of the role and political power of the supreme leader?
Yeah, I mean, that's, as I mentioned, I mean, that's if you ask me about the biggest mistake that Islamic State did after the revolution was in the education system. I mean, from their perspective, they lost everything. I mean, they have lost this religious credential, particularly for the clerics and clergy in the grassroots level. And I think the supreme leader is a key player in holding that line, the official rhetoric of the community, the country being religious. And that's one of the, I think, important factors that we need to look what will happen with the next supreme leader, if we are going to have another one, who is going to be, and if he is not as strict adamant as Khamenei, then many things can change in Iran. If it loosens up, I mean, the supreme leader office loosens up a bit to accept these changes, the transformation that has happened in the country, the social level, then many things will change.
Because it's possible we won't have another supreme leader, isn't it? Right.
Yeah, I mean, according to the constitution, when supreme leader dies, there will be a council, including three people, and there is no time limit for that. So when Rafsanjani was alive, there was a talk that Rafsanjani is moving to having some sort of setting that they will have a three members of council,
yeah, the council
of the supreme leader, and then it will go on forever in a way, I mean, in a de facto situation. Mm. But I don't know. I mean, it's one of those questions that I can never say an answer to that.
Alice, do you want to say something about the changes in Iranian society?
I'd only say that I think that's probably putting it too strongly. There's always been talk of secularism in Iran. It was around just after the revolution. It was people were still talking about it, you know, in the late 1980s. And then, you know, Khatami came in and was seemed to be kind of moving around into a sort of more secular direction. I think it's perhaps better to view these things in a cyclical way. I really couldn't call it, and I couldn't also say that Iranians now are more pro-secularism than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. I'm not sure.
John Connor, in this, I realise that the Supreme Leader has control of foreign policy, but notwithstanding that, one suspects that some nuances of that do play in elections and in people's electoral feeling. Has there been any overt utterances in relation to either one, the obvious conflicts with Saudi Arabia, and or two, Israel, in these electoral proceedings?
Not sure regarding Israel, but it's there were certainly some issues going around about the former mayor of Tehran, who really is in the reformist camp, who was publicly critical of Iran's role in Syria, for instance, and saying that diplomacy should be the first role of Iran and not military force.
This is Qarabashi, who was a mayor back in the 1990s. Yeah.
So somebody who is a public figure on the reformist camp, but it was very, not only was he held down by the principalists, so the conservatives, he's also held down by Rouhani's camp very quickly, saying that, sure, diplomacy has its place, but while we're fighting terrorists, you have to defeat the terrorists first and diplomacy follows after. So I think as far as probably similarly to what you would see in Australia, where there's commitment of your own forces overseas for whatever reason in that kind of political milieu, then there has to be unity. So you're not going to publicly ever criticise the use of or Syria's military policy, sorry, Iran's military policy in Syria. At the same time, I think you are seeing already pushback from Iran in terms of external threats. So, you know, Secretary of Defense Mattis, you know, previously when he was asked what are the biggest threats that he sees, and he went Iran 1, 2, and 3. He's obviously advising President Trump, and we also saw last week, Mohammed bin Salman gave a very public interview, again reiterating the deputy crown prince
in Saudi Arabia.
And the king's son, who is one of the leading figures in Saudi society and politics, and the architect of the intervention in Yemen, saying that Iran, that normal Saudi line about Iran being responsible for the unrest in the region, but also at the same time saying that, and we don't want Iranian, before we see Iranian unrest in Saudi Arabia, we're going to see, essentially, we're going to fix it in Iran. Very, very forward-leaning remarks. And the Iranian defense minister said that if it came to that, we would essentially obliterate Saudi Arabia, except for the two holy sites. And at the same time, we saw 10 Iranian border guards killed down in Sistani, Balochistan by Sunni group from Pakistan that evidently was launched the attack from Pakistani soil. And the head of the Iranian military said that essentially if Pakistan can't sort out the threat to Iran from Pakistan, then they might need to intervene. And we saw Foreign Minister Zarif travel to Pakistan to ask Pakistan to sort out its border. So Iran at the moment is seeing threats in multiple directions. So as a result of that, I think you'll see both sides of politics reinforcing Iran's right to protect itself, and you'll see and hear quite strong rhetoric to that effect.
We have time for one more question.
Are the elections in Iran, are they free, open to all citizens? Is there much corruption?
No, I mean, the only thing that you cannot use is that the free election in Iran and open for the all citizens. But it doesn't mean that there is no competition. It doesn't mean that it's meaningless or it's just showcase for the people. That's what I was saying, that I mean, the Iran system has got these two pillars, these two components, electoral and theocratic components, and they play a role in the whole, I mean, political mosaic of the country, significant role for both sides. So it's not free, it's blatantly manipulated, particularly with the Guardian Council, who's formed from the 12 members, directly or indirectly appointed by the Supreme Leader. Six of them are directly appointed by the Supreme Leader, and six others are introduced by the head of the judiciary, which is again the appointees of the Supreme Leader. They are all conservative. None of the reformists are in this Guardian Council, and the Guardian Council is the only watchdog, I mean, approving the eligibility of the candidates before the election and confirming the election results after the election. So it's not free or fair, but at the same time, within that framework of those who are, being eligible to run for the election, there is a real competition, and it's very important.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to bring it to a close. As I said in the introduction, I could talk about this stuff all day. Iranian politics is endlessly fascinating. But we do have to let people get back to their daily chores. Please join me in thanking our panelists today.